from Tukito LLC. It's Keto Woman Podcast with Daisy Brackenhall.
Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight, after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. Keto has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman Podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs to 20 grams or less per day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein, scale to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. I'll be asking my guest each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history and so have access to the bigger picture. Thank you, Tamara Palmer, for supporting me and this podcast by making a pledge at my Patreon page. Do you want to hear your name here at the top of the show? Are you enjoying this podcast and would like to help me make more episodes? Then head to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It means a great deal to me, and you will get to headline the show just like Tamara did today. This week's extraordinary woman is Annette Bosworth, MD. Annette is an internal medicine physician based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. She has over 19 years of experience helping patients overcome long-term chronic conditions through lifestyle adjustment, preventative medicine, and other therapeutic paths. She's been mentioned in media outlets ranging from CNN, Time, US News and World Report to Fox News. In addition to medicine, she loves speaking at town halls, jails, churches, and universities. From politics to mission work, she lets her faith lead her to the next chapter of life, always looking for teachable moments. Along with her husband, she savours the adventure of raising three energetic, fast-growing sons through debate, wrestling, music and theatre. She fights for the underdog and encourages patients with chronic health problems to fight it any way you can, ketones for life. There was just too much to cover in Annette's story to cram into just one episode, so we are taking 2 weeks to tell it all. Let's get started then with part one. Welcome, Annette, to the Keto Woman Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to be talking to you. We met all too briefly, really, at Keto Fest, didn't we? And I've been really looking forward to hearing your story.
Yes, I, at the last minute, said I'm going to clear my schedule and attend what I'd been listening to for 2 years. And sometimes a busy life, kids, clinic, and everything says, another conference, can I afford to take the break? And I'm so thankful that I did.
Yeah, it's a different experience from what I gather. I haven't been to that many conferences. I only have the conference really that I went to in London earlier this year to compare. But by all accounts, that was a very typical conference. But Keto Fest, I think, is a very not typical conference.
Right. I went in not knowing anyone. I mean, I'd known voices on a podcast and a few people from the forum, but nobody in person. In fact, the people that I was hoping to meet, one of the experts from Australia, I sent him the first email after I bought the tickets, and he goes, "Oh, bugger, I'm sorry. I can't come."
I'm oh, like, no.
Oh, no. But it turned out it was a blessing. It was great to just be present and watch. I've been to lots of medical conferences, and this was very connective, very relational. And I think in this journey of, forging advice as a physician, but also as a mom and a wife and a advisor to schools, this journey is lonely. And so it was really comforting to have those relationships in person, not just, the 21st century relationships where, I follow them on Instagram or something, So I'm very thankful.
Yes, it makes a big difference. Yes. And it made a huge difference to me because a lot of the people I've been speaking to and have been friends with for best part of a couple of years now. And it was my opportunity to meet them all for the first time. So I keep repeating Richard's phrase, but meeting old friends for the first time.
Amen. That's exactly.
Really, really was.
It's well captured.
And you do really feel part of something when you're there, don't you? And like you say, the connections mm-hmm. you make, real proper tribe connections.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's we're going to come back to that for my top tip is your tribe. So we're going to weave that uh-huh. in throughout this. I'm very mindful of my top tip.
Funny story, actually. I was asked for a top tip. I did a video interview with the diet doctor team when I was at the conference in London, and they asked me for a top tip. They had actually given me the questions. I wasn't aware of it because I hadn't seen the email. And so we get to the top tip and I was completely floored. It's of all the people who should have a top tip prepared, you should. Shame on you.
Well, you're forgiven.
Anyway, I want to hear your story because it's a very interesting one. So start wherever you like.
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you. It is an incredible honor to be part of your list of guests. It's very inspiring to hear how their journeys of before keto, what this keto experience has done for them, and then life afterwards. And I have followed your stories, followed the women, learned great deals from them. And I just feel really honored to be one of your guests. So thank you for having me. I've been an internal medicine doctor now for 20 years, and I have a background that I think is relevant to strong women everywhere. I'm the firstborn in a farming family where they prayed for strong sons, and they got me.
So you had to make up for that and show them you were just as strong, thank you very much, and more so probably.
Right. You think only boys can do that? Let me show you what girls can do. And I grew up in a real small town, a population of about 800. So K through 12 is in one building, and you start kindergarten with 21 kids in your class, and you graduate 13 years later with practically the same 21. It's like a family. But what happened in my journey of life is I'm very connected to my community. My mom is a real live Mary Poppins. She is very connected to her community. We are in the middle of nowhere, 50 miles from a hospital at the time, 30 miles from a major grocery store, and 10 miles from town. And town is 800, so we're really in the middle of nowhere. But that did not stop her in, 1970 and 1980s to say, nope, this little town depends on people stepping up and being a part of a community and taking responsibility. If you want a safe and committed town, you got to show up and do your part. And that was a very big part of the threads that have wove through my blood and my story. And I've learned that it's very attractive to other women to say, how do we make a difference? Just last night, there was another shooting in America where, moms send their kids to school today saying, please don't let them get hurt. And you say, how do you impact this? And I believe it starts with your local communities. You cannot fix this without, I believe, women signing up and being a part of your community. And that's a big theme to the story that I'm going to tell you today. which is my life before keto and then what keto has done and how it's changed my whole practice of medicine. So as I said, I'm a hog farmer's daughter. I grew up, my dad had an evil trick that, he had two daughters and a son, but we were cute and we were cheerleaders and we were popular. I'm very social, very extroverted. I love people. And, when I was, I think 13 was when he decided that the girls were going to be the ones in charge of cleaning the hog barn.
Nice.
That happens once a week at our farm. And I don't know if you've ever studied the potency of smells, but a hog smell ranks like number one next, or maybe two next to skunk. For once it's in your skin, you're in trouble. You're going to exuberate this smell for, So yeah, Saturdays, cause we went out on Saturday nights, Saturdays were the day we were going to clean the hog barn.
Oh, bad choice.
Oh, strategic choice. He was very strategic.
Was this an anti-boyfriend scent?
Absolutely. It's like if there were pheromones that came out of teenagers, you stopped them when the smell of hogs landed on your hair or your body. So my sister and I, we came up with some pretty great ways to counteract Dad's plan. We did things like we took rubber gloves and we put them over our heads to put our hair in. We took saran wrap and we put it under our clothes in hopes that the smell wouldn't actually touch our skin. And some of that worked. But the point is that, you know, we were very involved in our community and I grew up on this family of very strong work ethic. And from a very young age, I was responsible for how our farming did. I had chores. I had, if you didn't get chores done, you weren't allowed to have a car to go anywhere. And so there was a really strong work ethic. And, I can remember a very important day when I was in the seventh grade. There's this little school that had an assembly and the assembly gathered all these students and these two kids who had been to college were going to lead the assembly, and their last name was Adams, and they were really, you know, prominent people in my little community, and their kids had come home from this fancy school, and they were leading the assembly, and I'm this little seventh grader with, you know, pigtails practically, and they tell about the college they'd chose, and one had been in a fraternity, and these were kind of new concepts to me in the seventh grade. And it sounded very exciting. And as soon as they were done with their presentation, I shot my hand in the air and I'm like, what's your job? And they had had a degree in music, which although is lovely, they didn't have an answer. And I had ridden my bike to school that day. And I remember riding my bike home so angry, like the world didn't match. They had gone to college. They had had this thing that was supposed to lead to a job and they didn't have a job. And at the end of our driveway, which is about a half mile long, I would pick up the mail. And that day, Time magazine was in the mailbox. And I open up the Time magazine because on the front, it had job placement. And it said, if you train in this field, what's the percentage of people that work there? And I can remember riding my bike down the driveway with no hands on a gravel road, finding the article that said, what's at the top? I can't imagine going through all this, getting the privilege to go to a college and then not having a job. And way at the top was medicine. You know, this is probably 1985 or something. I don't know. And way at the top was if you trained in medicine, you had like 97 or 95% of the people were working in medicine. And then their job satisfaction was in that column too. And they liked what they did. And all I kept thinking is, oh, it's got to be better than hog chores. It's got to be better. And, you know, I was the first in my family to go to a four-year college to, you know, I've run into some adversity problems early on. Hog farming was one of our staples for income. And I graduated from high school in 1990. And the hog market went to to pot in 1988. So I can remember my dad coming down to the basement, which is where my bedroom was. And he's very somber. He said, I know I've promised you that you could go to college, but this is a really tough market. And I can't understand what he's saying. All I know is that I was supposed to get good grades. I was supposed to stay out of trouble. I was going to get the chance to leave this little town that I swore I wasn't going to spend the rest of my life in. And I've never seen my dad cry, but he couldn't get the words out to tell me this little fund I have for you is not here. And I was heartbroken. I was like, no, there's got to be a way. And so in true spirit of who I am, I had just won the homecoming queen from my town. And that turns into a bunch of mail. And so somebody sent me a letter saying, if you are your local homecoming queen, you are automatically entered into this contest for, you know, women and leadership, and you need to have, speaking skills. And that was one of my passions in high school too, was to be an oral interp, and to be public speaking was very important or very fun for me. And so I told my parents I had something to do with school. I took a sequins gown and headed to a little town in South Dakota. Didn't tell them what I was doing. And because if you won, you got a year in college. And I thought, oh, this will be great. I'll just do this. And of course I'll win, right? So I went to this little thing and I won. And then I saw that the fine print said, you have to win nationals to get the college. And I remember driving home going, oh, that means I got to tell my parents where I've been. And I got to figure out how to get to Hawaii in like 4 months or something.
Hawaii, crikey.
I know, my dad had never been on an airplane before. It was their 25th wedding anniversary. And of course, you know, as much as I was worried about being, you know, I'd done something out with my parents' permission, and they were really proud that I'd done so well, and that, you know, so here we were going off to nationals, and I get to this national competition, and these girls are beautiful, and they're all articulate, and they're all super smart, and I'm out of my league, I'm just myself.
Yeah, so just an interjection there for anyone who poo-poos the idea of these kind of events, right? Because they do have a bit of a stereotype and a stigma attached, don't they? But actually, quite often when you dig underneath, they're comprised of pretty formidable women.
It's amazing. I didn't know any stereotypes. All I could see was, if you did well, you got this thing that I really wanted help with, which was entrance into college. I had the grades. I had the desire. I didn't have the money. And I get to this place and these women they've been the president of the debate team. They know all about politics and like policy that I hadn't even heard of. And so I feel completely outclassed, but I feel so privileged to just be there representing my state, and this pride factor of being from my little town and saying, I'm the one from South Dakota there. I need to at least do my best and show that my state's filled with wonderful, kind, hardworking people who we're all about just making sure you have this human connection with other people. And it turns out that was really important and part of the judging process. I didn't know that. And so I get all the way up to the top five of these contests. And they take you behind the stage, and I'm amazed. I'm like, top five, the top three all get the year in college. And they take you behind and they do not shady, but they say, now, you know, if you win, you have to do this 2-week tour in Europe and something about a world competition. And I'm thinking, how do you do that and still get good grades in college? Wouldn't you like fail? And I'm like, all I'm thinking about is if you're letting me into college, I'm not going to fail. I'm not going to fail. And so I really think that influenced who was able to win, but I didn't care as long as I was enough to get the top three, and I got the lowest you could possibly get and still get a year of college. And I tell that story because there are so many threads about what I'm about to tell you that says, when you tell me there's not a way, I'm going to stand back and look around and say, how can we get the end goal And this really becomes an important part of that, you know, what has keto done for me? I mean, what is the end goal for my patients? And how do we help them without overwhelming them? So I get this first year in college, and when I get to college, I do well. I really commit to, making sure that I didn't waste this opportunity. Turns out it's a lot easier to get scholarships once you've shown a year of performance in school.
I was going to say that, you know, the first year sounds like this tantalizing taste of what you could have, but because in America it's 4 years in total, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So you've got, how are you going to fund the other 3 years? But I guess, yeah, you just answered that question that was popping into my mind.
Right. And I think it's also this foretelling that when life gives you adversity and you don't know how it's going to turn out, you get to choose this next little step. And when you can just stay in the moment, when you cannot let the anxiety pull you out of the panic, when you can have your ropes connected to other grounded people, I do believe that is so valuable for getting through a tough time, getting through a difficult, you know, chapter in life.
That's very true, actually. And that's an interesting mindset to have. Certainly what was going through my mind was I tend to overthink things and look too forward in time and worry about what could happen. So I would automatically be thinking, well, they paid for the first year, but there are 4 years in total. Well, how on earth am I going to fund the other 3 years? But it could be to the extent that it would stop you doing that first year, because you think, well, what is the point? Because I can't do all of it. And so it's, yes, I think that's a very valuable lesson to take away, is being in the moment and just go and experience that, and believing, having faith that something will turn up that will allow you to continue.
Right. And I really think that as I coach patients, I do a lot with brains. I'm in internal medicine, but if I had to put a label on my clinic, it would be, we collect broken brains and we fix them. And it's a host of reasons why your brain doesn't work right. But when that mentality gets to solving all of the future's problems, you forgot to fix the ones from that you could do something about today. And that'll keep you stuck for 30 years. You'll be just stuck forever. And, you know, from a very young age, I was told I couldn't go to college, and that meant I was going to end up in Plankinton, South Dakota forever. And although I love my hometown, and I look back with nostalgia that's probably more grand than it deserves, but I don't care. But it's a powerful lesson for taking in what you can do right now today. And then my goal was, I didn't want to end up there forever. And step one was, you got to get to college. Don't even think about this Time magazine of, you know, you show up in biology class and you have 400 people in that room, and I think it was six other classes of exactly that profile. And I think two of you are going to get to medical school. I'm like,
wow.
Don't think about that.
Really? Gosh, that's a scary percentage.
Right. And so you don't think about that because you're just going to freeze. There's like no way that you're going to be the one that makes it. So I did what I knew best, which was buckle down, not be tempted with the fun parts of college, which I was a college cheerleader. It wasn't that I didn't have fun, but I was very scripted in, if you wanted to know where I was at the library. I met my husband in college, and I tell this story. He saw me at a bar the week before school, and I had joined one of these sororities, and it was a great tribe of other women, good study habits. It doesn't sound like the culture that you think of when you think sorority. You think what it happens on movies. But the truth is it is a sisterhood of saying, no, no, no. If you want to figure out how to succeed in 21st century, you need some examples of other women that have done it. And how do you sort them quickly, because you don't get to do your freshman year of college over again when it was gifted to you by this random chance of a contest based in Hawaii. Like, oof.
Another sisterhood, by the sounds of it. You sound like you've moved from sisterhood to sisterhood.
Right, where in my little town of 800 people, you didn't get to select your friends. This is who lived there. And so you had to find the friendships and the strengths that you were going to be able to enhance your life or enhance their life with the people in front of you. You know, I think as I've grown through life, that upbringing of a very small tribe that doesn't change was find the value in the ones in front of you. And boy, is that a great lesson for every chapter of our life, that quit looking around for the next best thing and just take in what you have right in front of you. And as I had gone to college, I'm now in my fourth year. When I looked at this fourth year of college, it was the hardest year of college for me. And I had shown up in it's called Rush Week. And I thought of this as all of the fun I was going to get to have the whole semester was before school started, because I think I was in like biochemistry and advanced chem. I mean, there was a lot on the deck for me for performance, and I was taking the big test called the MCAT that semester. So my husband comes to college that year in my college. He transferred colleges, and his sister was in my sorority, and his sister takes him to the bar, and I don't remember the story, but he tells the story from his point of view, that he saw me across the bar and says to his sister, "Who is that?" And she said, "Oh, she's in my sorority. She was a cheerleader with me, but you do not want to meet her. She studies all the time." And if you ever meet my husband, I think he was just born brilliant. So he remembers coming up and asking me a question that night, and I don't remember him at all. And so I go on with the rest of my year, which is, a very strict schedule of studying. And I had a bicycle that I got around in college with, and I'd time that it was 4.5 minutes from the library to the place where I would have my supper. And if I timed it just wrong, like if you're 10 seconds late, you cannot eat with the house mother. She is very strict about manners, and you had to be in the room and sing the grace with the girls, or you didn't get to eat with the house mother. Well, dang, I calculated that wrong. It's a repeating theme in my life that I studied right up to the last minute, and I would not leave any time for like not unlocking my bike, you know, incorrectly the first time. So I would cut it too close.
No contingency wiggle room there at all.
So I ate supper. My husband had become a houseboy at our house. A houseboy means they help with dishes and they get free meals and they get a date to all of our formals. And he had become the houseboy at our house with the specific intent to get a date with me. And of course, I don't know this, but I'm notoriously late for supper. So I'm eating supper with him every night for a year. I have kind of sworn off that I don't have time for boys. I've had a heartbreak over the last year, and he proceeds to ask me out every night for a year. And I'm like, nope, you don't fit my checklist. This is not the right timing. I am very focused on where I'm going, and I cannot afford to not succeed. I do not want to end up back doing hog chores the rest of my life. And, you know, it takes a year for me to say yes to his date. And we just celebrated 20 years of marriage and about 24 years together. But the point of that is even when something, you know, you practice taking advantage of how can I appreciate the ones in front of you. If you get too goal focused, if your blinders are on, sometimes you can't see the blessing right in front of you.
Lucky he was persistent.
I often wonder, would he ask that hard now that he knows what he's got?
And I wonder what the tipping point would have been. How long would he have gone on asking? Would he have carried on for the full 4 years, I wonder?
You know, I'll tell you, I think that's what got my attention was, I'm like, oh, this guy is brilliant. And he is adventurous, which I think is a very fun mate to have, is one that wants to try and risk and do things beyond what I had imagined. But I don't think there was a lot of leftover time. I think I pushed it as far as I could push it. And it turned out that it was good timing. Dating somebody in medical school that's not fun. You're kind of a slave to the demands. And then those first few years of residency aren't any better. So it's like the first 7 years of our relationship, dialed in, you know, dialed into a level that was very committed, but not available.
And was he studying the same subject, or was he doing something different?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, his training essentially is an economist. He can look for opportunities, find a time when this is a good investment, this is a good time to put energy here, this is a walk away. So that's been very good, you know, very good augmentation to how do you take a skill like medicine and not get trapped in today's medicine, which is see as many patients as possible in as short amount of time as possible to make the bills all work. And I don't subscribe to that. But that's not a good economic choice. It's difficult, in today's medical world, because of the way it's all set up. My husband and I, got married. We got married right between medical school and residency, and I was selected to go to residency at the University of Utah. And that was wonderful, but it was a long ways from home and was my first time really expanding my wings and stepping out into the world of what medicine could teach me, how rich of an experience it is to be a physician. Again, not a lot of mentors in my life that had lived this life. It was kind of this mythical experience that I had almost voyeurism, like you could see it from the outside, but you really didn't understand what you said yes to until you got into residency and you were one-on-one. And I found that where my highest attraction, what I really liked in medicine, was where there were perfect answers. And this has a lot to do with keto, where if it was a black and white answer, it was much easier to go on with the day. When you have these decisions that are gray, oh, no way. That's just, it causes anxiety. You wonder if you made the right choice. The patient didn't hear you correctly or didn't quite understand the depth of what you were offering. And that was a lot more stressful. So if I could find the part in medicine where there's black and white answers, that patients don't really argue with you, you just tell them what to do and then you do it, that was going to be where that sounds good. So I think that turned out to be the people who did pathology, where the patient's not alive anymore. Yeah. Or maybe the ones that are intubated. So they are in the ICU, they're hooked up to all these machines, they cannot argue with you.
Basically, you've got to take away the ability of choice.
So I was certain this was where I belonged. And I'm very analytical. I love the formula of the right answer. So it turns out in an ICU team, you use this collaborative effect. So there was my community that I really needed in my life to feel whole. So this ICU community worked as a team to get people better. And I was part of this really fun study that said, what's the number one thing that causes death in an ICU? And our ICU was one of the top ones in the country, and the results were about to come out. And I was sure it was going to be like hand washing or something that was black and white. Or if you took them off the ventilator at this point versus that point, it was going to be a yes or no. And when the answer came back that the highest risk of death came when someone on your team was going through a divorce or a loss.
Wow.
That blew my mind. Like, I can't control for that. That's so not fair. And in the end, I just think it was another one of those moments where, all right, to live in the moment where you can control this and not look too far ahead is a repeating theme. So I had done some slave labor in my final year of residency to get this fellowship. So here you get into medical school, you think that's the heaviest lift. Now you get into this residency, and if you want a fellowship, which is where the specialists in our country, we do the specialists after this. If I wanted to study ICU medicine, like 1 in 50 of the applicants of these super smart, very advanced people were going to get into this fellowship. And once again, I'm like, I can't compete that high of a level. There's no way I'll get the fellowship. But I could offer my services on top of the like 140-hour work week, I could volunteer in the sleep lab to do extra work for them, which is ridiculous when you add up all the hours. But it was a really big part of what turned into my medical career was studying sleep, studying how a brain heals, how important it was that the chemicals that you put in your brain or in your body, how it affects your brain.
Slightly ironic for somebody who's working very long hours as well.
I know, right? Like, oh, we used to take bets on who was having, you could see certain chemicals affect the brain. And as the folks running the electrical stimulation, like electrical brain waves in a sleep lab, we would take bets on saying, well, who's on these drugs? But what we never did was look at ourselves. Like, danger.
Yeah, it would have been interesting.
Right. So I get all the way to my end of my residency, and my husband and I had been trying to get pregnant, and thankfully we did, a lot faster than I planned on, like 2 weeks off of birth control and I'm pregnant, which actually was not in the plan. But I think it was exactly what I needed to remind myself that if you choose this intense life of an ICU physician, it comes with saying yes to one thing is saying no to something else. And that turned out to be really valuable. My son was born in December, and I was sitting there holding him when they offered me a fellowship. And I said, you know, this is not the path I want to go. I'm just not going to do that. And I have never looked back. I mean, I've been a primary care physician. I entered into a place where I got to be the mom to three wonderful boys. You know, the journey of raising a family has been as rewarding as I could have imagined it. We moved back to South Dakota about 10 years after living in Utah, had all of our kids in Utah. And then I had been part of a system where I'd been paid for performance. And I think this is also one of the vital reasons that has taken me into dive full-fledged into a ketogenic diet for my practice, is that those first formative years as a physician was something where I was part of a huge medical system where they would keep track of how well were your patients losing weight? How well were your patients' blood pressure controlled? Did you screen them for depression? And these are little checkpoints that if you have like a checklist manifesto where you're going through the airline pilot to say, do you have everything done? If you did everything perfectly on every visit, there would be no problem. And that's a really good idea until you remember that you're seeing a human. Like,
well, exactly. I mean, you know, just as you were saying that, it sounds A, like it has the potential to influence how you interact with patients in the first place, because mm-hmm. you've got this checklist going on in your mind. But also, it reminds me of that the result in the ICU, where it's very unfair because you can never predict Mm-mm. what's going to happen with who comes in and what they're going to do with the information you give them.
Exactly. And what I had done was I was the first one in that clinic to be an electronic healthcare recorder, meaning I've never touched a paper chart. I've always been able to analyze how was I doing, and it wasn't just my opinion of myself. It was actually evidence of, oh, you only checked the blood pressure in 70% of your patients. I'm like, how is that possible? We check the blood pressure of everybody. Well, I remember that patient showed up late. We didn't quite get it done. And, you know, so there was plenty of places in life where the human part got in the way of our data collection part. And what this did, though, was the first quarter that I was in the system, you get a printout and you are assigned a number. So nobody else knows what your number is, but you're lined up against all the other physicians that are like you. So I was in a pool of other internal medicine physicians that work in an outpatient setting. They don't work in a hospital. There were also several family practice doctors that were in a similar pool. And I mean, I'd been like in practice 6 weeks, so I wasn't even full data for the full quarter, but I was the lowest. It was like my biggest nightmare, like, oh, no, no, no. I can't be the worst doctor out there, could I? And so it was very motivating. I'm very competitive, but I'm also a huge, you know, relational person. Like I can't say, hey, stop speaking and telling me about how your son just died. I need to do a depression screen. Like, no, that doesn't work. That's really rude. And it doesn't connect to the person. They don't want to see you again. That's obvious, right? So what happened was a process of being very methodical about data at a time where you weren't seeing me. So my nurse would call and say, you know what, you're going to see the doctor in a couple of days, and we just want to make sure we have the meds straight. Or we would often send them a list of, here's what we think you're coming in for. Is this what you want to cover on that visit? So that we would have the time available for them, but also we could cover some of those data points. And this process of checking in with the patient before they came in or doing some of these things electronically was powerful. I think it was 6 quarters before I was number one in the system.
Wow.
And really had transitioned. You can relate to patients, but if your checklist is all they see, they're not going to engage in the process of what you're trying to do. And they're going to not come back and see you because who would want to do that? But I also think that those checklists are there to say, hey, doc, I know that there's always a crisis going on in the patient's life, but your job is to feed the bottom of the foundation to their health, which is their weight, which is their blood pressure, which is how is their brain working. You know, some of those basic measurements of what's their waist circumference. Well, I don't have time for that. I didn't have a measuring tool in my clinic. Oh, but that was one of the big markers for, do you have metabolic syndrome? What's your waist? Does it have a size beyond? And if it was a male, it was one number, a female, another. That was, if you were going to do one thing, you didn't need a blood pressure cuff. You didn't need a heart rate. You needed a measurement of their waist. And so this data collection merged with my need to connect with a person, with a patient. And it was wonderful. So when I moved back to South Dakota, I tried infusing that culture that I had been practicing for 10 years into a system that was just beginning to figure that out. They wanted a leader. And it didn't take long for me to see I couldn't rewind my skills as far back as the system was at. They were going to get there. But I made the decision to step out onto my own and say, I need to be in my own practice. And when you do that, leaving a big system today, many of them have something called a non-compete. Non-compete means we paid for those patients to come to you. We advertised for you. We recruited you. And that was a cost that if you're going to leave our system and start your own business, you need to either pay us back or you need to leave the environment. I just moved 3 little kids across the country and a husband. This was the year my mom got diagnosed with a cancer. My husband, who's also a firstborn, and I say that because the firstborns tend to be the caretakers for the parents. That's not always true, but the firstborn female is almost always a caretaker for the parents, but it was really a connection for both of us to say his dad had gotten some warning signs of some bad health. His mom had breast cancer. My mom had cancer. And we were like, how many more signs from God do we need to say, all right, we need to move back to South Dakota? And so back there, within a short order, we realized I'm going to start my own company. And that was going to be this 2-year non-compete. One of the downsides was if I was going to have this 2-year non-compete, I had to move away or find a negotiation. So I met with a company and we talked about there has to be another solution. My kids just started school. And they said, well, if you see the homeless or Medicaid for 2 years, we'll let you do that. I'm like, done. Those are good people. So I began as the physician seeing teenagers in these shelters where Medicaid was a major source of their population. And this was at the same time where I had the unbelievable opportunity to go to Haiti. And I cheek that statement just a little bit because I say it's an unbelievable opportunity, but really my husband drug me there kicking and screaming. I had those blinders on again, and I had this focus that said, hey, there's got to be a way that I can leave this company and still start a business. And I was kind of irritated about the restrictions that were being put up. And I was trying to solve all of the problems for the next 10 years in the next month. And my husband does a really good job of saying, just look at today. And this was a few months after that earthquake in 2010 in Haiti, where it had demolished their whole world. And a clipboard went around our church and said, is anybody willing to help? And I don't even remember the clipboard coming to our pew, but my husband put our names down. And the next week, this woman calls and says, it says on this form that you're a doctor. And I'm like,
perfect.
No. I'm not a doctor in Haiti. And she's got this really strong Southern accent. And, she's like, well, what kind of doctor are you in America? I'm like, I'm an internal medicine with a computer. And I've got to have the data and the process and the checklist in order for me to do a good job. And she was very strong in her faith. And she's like, well, I'm going to say you should pray about that and I'll call you tomorrow. She hung up the phone and I'm like, I spoke to God. He said, no, I'm not going. And my husband's like, just reflect a little bit. And, you know, he just has this ability to touch me in my stubborn moments and say, just pause. This is not a bad thing. And again, I couldn't have picked out where Haiti was on the map at the time. I knew it was an island in the middle of nowhere that had hurricanes and it had earthquakes. And, you know, I showed up in Haiti and I found a community in such need that the struggles that I had blown up in my mind about starting a practice, being, you know, in medicine with, you know, only seeing Medicaid and the income was going to be a problem. Suddenly it was embarrassing how much of that bothered me, but it inspired me to say, all right, dive in, just lean into this problem and see what you can do. And I screwed it up. There was lots of things that were easy to take care of that I just didn't have any exposure to. And it took several trips back to that mission field for me to really embrace what it's like to have no script for tomorrow. And here was this world in Haiti who there were kids 3 months later that still were looking for their parents. They're just in shock. Their brains were in shock. And they just were stuck. And I equate that a lot to some of the patients I see in the last couple years where they've been in a brain fog for the better part of a decade. Their ability to make a decision is just so clouded that they default the decisions forward again and again. And this is this is a trauma, that their trauma is the kind of the soup that's happened to their brain, as opposed to the trauma that would happen into those people in Haiti. The connection is very clear if you're the one standing back as the observer. But to them, they're looking for anybody to slow down and take one step with them and then take another step with them. And my busy life, my checklist manifesto, my be good at the numbers was just glaring at me saying, it's great to be good at that, but don't forget about the person. And it still makes me emotional, like how much that changed how I approach patients.
It's an interesting comparison to make as well, that because I know it's something that people often say, and that always that thing that you have that you compare yourself to somebody else. You know, what am I complaining about when there's someone in Haiti who's lost their parents? But I just find it very interesting and very touching that you do see that connection, that, you know, trauma is trauma to the individual, and that you recognize that wherever it's coming from.
Right. And, you know, I've listened to your podcast and heard about, you know, other women who say, I've learned not to have judgment for somebody in their story, that is, you know, the obese patient that comes in and they've lost 100 pounds, but they still have to bear the weight of someone saying, well, they're so fat, they must be, and fill in the adjective, that lazy or sloth like effect. And that is so difficult to kind of slam that lesson into somebody else's mind to say, don't do that. Do not assume that you understand why they're acting that way. I mean, these kids were begging for anything. They were begging for love and for connection. I mean, food was one thing, but they wanted a connection. And it's overwhelming. It's suffocating. You get 50 children just seeing this white person with resources. And I can barely breathe thinking about it because there was so much need. And I often feel that hunger of someone help me when that brain fogged patient walks in saying, I've been to 30 doctors. I've spent so much money. And you just have to pause and say, from their point of view, try to understand. And it's been a really helpful lesson in medicine that I still screw it up. I still am not perfect by any means. But when I allow myself the space to say, back up, understand their perspective, it changed how I said, okay, we can do a better job in medicine. And so I returned from Haiti multiple times, took several mission trips to Haiti, took my children to Haiti, took medical students to Haiti, and really found this servant's spirit in everything I did. And there were some points of contention that I had with the local government in South Dakota and how they were running the Medicaid. The first, you can say, battle was when you're in Haiti, there's two lines for bread. One line for bread was men, and the other line for bread was women and children. And the women and children were buying bread that was more expensive, and it had a unique flavor to it. Like, I didn't like it. And it actually took me a couple of visits to Haiti to realize, oh, there's clay in the bread for the women and children.
What's that all about?
Right. Like, what are you doing? Why? What is that? And there's a really powerful story. When I was super irritated on the second trip to Haiti, I had known that there was a problem with parasites or pinworms. And I was trying to sort out who was having it and who didn't. But I wanted a blood test. I wanted it to be easy. And I can remember looking up from this tent, and there's, like, in my mind, there was 500 people waiting to see me. And it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm hungry, and I'm hot, and I'm irritated because everybody has the same symptoms. Their head hurts. They have acid reflux. They are tired. They have no energy. And they have these big fat tummies. And I remember being particularly irritated with this boy who was like the 15th person in a row who has the same symptom. And it's kind of like God wanted me to slow down and think, because this kid puked pinworms all over my feet.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, time out. What the heck? And it was like this flash of information came into my mind that says, oh, this is pica syndrome. They're eating clay because they're malnourished. That's what's in the bread. And if you've ever heard of a woman getting to the end of pregnancy and she'll want to chew on ice, have you ever heard of that? That's pica syndrome. She's very anemic. There's nothing in the ice that's going to help her, but there's something satisfying about chewing on strange things that isn't just in her, it's in every race possible. It's everywhere on Earth.
I remember looking it up, actually. You know, why is my dog eating the lime mortar out?
Yes.
Yeah, that's where I first came across it.
So here I was in Haiti and, you know, we're giving them all these vitamins. And I'm like, stop. You're just feeding the pinworms. We have to fix the pinworms before those vitamins are going to do any good. And there's nothing in the clay bread that made them healthier.
Right. I was just wondering, actually, because I have read before that there are certain type of clay type things you can take and powders that you can take that are supposed to help clear worms. So I was just wondering if that was the reason why it was in the bread in the first place.
Yeah, no, the key to their craving is there's several micronutrients, but the major deficiency is iron. And iron deficiency is A, really dangerous for brains. You cannot repair. This was something, if you want to have sleep apnea and be stuck in that forever, you can wear your CPAP machine. But if you're still iron deficiency anemic, iron deficiency even without anemia, your brain's not, it doesn't have the basic tool to make the structure to fix the brain problem. And so iron deficiency is a huge staple for my practice too. Like, just look, this is a blood test. I can tell you if you're low. And in these patients, when you get all the way to craving dirt, yeah, I don't need a blood test to say we've got a problem. So it turns out that not just in the Haitian culture, but in many cultures, when an animal would be sacrificed, the organ meat would be given to the children and the women.
Right. Rich in iron, of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. And, you know, all my keto folks know that now, but I'll tell you, lots of the folks don't know that. So I had gotten back to my home state, and in South Dakota, we have four of the poorest counties in America in my state. And many of the kids from these poor counties were ending up in my shelters. So I was seeing kids from these poor counties. And there were cultural things that I was learning about. The first one that was the most powerful to me was a girl who was probably 13. She's probably 200 pounds, very overweight, but she was malnourished. She couldn't project her voice. She'd been in the shelter for a couple of months by the time I met her. And when I got her into a private exam room, she told me she thought she was crazy. I said, honey, why do you think you're crazy? And she said, I go to the bathroom and I eat the toilet paper. And I said, let me do some checking. And sure enough, ferritin is this protein that carries iron around. And when it's under 20, we know you can't fix your own brain with it under 20. We love it above 50. Hers was less than 4. Like, they couldn't measure it.
Gosh.
And so the treatment for that can be iron, which, of course, if you want to take pills for that, it was going to take her like 2 years of taking 4 pills a day. So she would be constipated because iron taken in the pill form can be very constipating. So then I tried buying them liver, and they're teenagers in a refuge of sorts. They did not want to learn how to like liver. I don't blame them. They're teenagers. And you know, that's an acquired skill to like liver. So, all right, I can give you iron. I can infuse it into your blood. I do this to prepare you for a kidney transplant. It's been something I had done for many times in my career so far. If you were going to have a kidney transplant, we needed your iron levels to be very healthy before you had your transplant. So I look up the indications. I actually call somebody from the University of Texas who takes care of kids and says, is there any reason we can't do this? He's like, no, here's the protocol we use. So here I am in the shelter. I check the history of many of these poverty children, and they had different cultural rituals. Some of them ate kitty litter. Some of them ate the ashes off of the tip of a burnt match stick. And so strange things they were craving. And you say, why are you doing this? And then you just looked at everybody's ferritin. And the lab called me the day that I just said, we're just ordering everybody's ferritin. And I treated it almost like a population health community, you know, like not just one person, let's just look. And like the ratio of less than four ferritins was like, I think, half of them. And so I just implemented a protocol that says, okay, we have to fix this if we're going to get them feeling better. And I think the best story comes back to that first patient who had, you know, she'd been a teenager. She'd been overweight, so overweight that she was just constantly bleeding from her menstruation cycle. Wasn't up and down anymore. It was just constantly bleeding. And here she was anemic and bleeding and eating toilet paper in the bathroom. And I remember giving her an infusion of iron. And the next week I came in, one of the symptoms of low iron is just the brain doesn't work right. In her case, that manifested by she couldn't project her voice. She would whisper. She would whisper as she talked to me. And I walked through the shelter door. And from across the room, she says, Dr. Bosworth. And instantly I'm like, oh, look at that brain. And the story comes full nature when you hear this wasn't just one kid. This was multiple. And so I implemented a protocol. And the next thing I know, I have the attorney general from South Dakota doing an investigation that I must be getting a kickback from these iron people because nobody else in the state gives this. And they said this word, Cadillac style of medicine, to these underserved people. And I can feel like if my mother's spirit could hop into my body, that it was my job to protect this community of people whose mothers weren't available right now. They were in a life section where moms were having trouble, whatever that was. It was my job to say, no, I'm the physician. I can see what needs to be done. Let me just show you the protocol. This is not my idea. Let me show you their ferritins. Let me show you that I bought Braunschweiger, which is liverwurst, to try and replace their iron. And I get these sticky notes saying, nobody else does this. Here's a 1973 textbook that says, you should do it this way. And I'm like, it's 2014 or 2012, whatever it was.
But how screwed up is that assumption that you're doing it for financial gain? You're not doing it because you've uncovered a problem,
right?
And took it upon yourself, you know, saw it as your responsibility to fix it.
Oh, it's still, I can hardly tell the story without just anger. Like, are you kidding? So I said, forget it. I'll pay for their iron. And they investigated me for Medicaid fraud. And I end up on the front page of the newspaper, investigated for Medicaid fraud. And what happens to a doctor when you get investigated for Medicaid fraud is all payments stop. Every payment. Insurance payments. If I saw you 3 months ago and they were about to send the check from Blue Cross Blue Shield or whatever insurance and you're under investigation for Medicaid fraud, all payments stop. And my husband and I have a choice to make. Like, running a clinic is expensive, especially when you're only seeing the underserved. And we were just about to exit this 2-year time when the Medicaid fraud hit. So we're just about to get paid the kind of reimbursements that would have been paid to a physician. And they put this freeze on the money.
Wow. That sounds like, we're about to find out about a very big life change. And on that note, we're going to take a break and leave everyone on a cliffhanger because we're going to do this interview in two parts because it's such a long and interesting story and we can't cover it all in 1 week. So we're going to say goodbye for this week and see you again next week.
Great. Thanks again.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It's thanks to the two keto dudes that I'm hosting this podcast. So please consider heading to their Patreon page at patreon.2keto.com and help them bring you more podcasts like this one. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on iTunes and Facebook. Every star and review really does help. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's end quote is from Dame Judi Dench. It takes courage to recognise the real as opposed to the convenient. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.